MacCast, Sunday, November 18th, 2018. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to be here with you for another episode of Apple and Mac news, information, all the stuff we talk about each week. And interestingly enough, this week looks like we have quite a few things to talk about. We're going to be talking about tearing down the iPad Pro and finding out what's inside, a little bit about analysts and their ambivalence about the future of iPhone sales and how that's sort of affecting the market and opinions that are out there. Also going to get into Apple confirming that T2 chip repairs. Yeah, there's some restrictions in there. And new updates to the MacBook Pro. Talk about that a little bit. And round the news out with a little bit of update on what Apple's doing with their original video content. And then we're going to get into some of your feedback. Talk about, you know, buying the Apple that you can afford. A little bit of information that plays into the discussions we've been having about Apple and pricing. We're going to get into some iPad Pro feedback. I'll give you a little bit more of my iPad Pro feedback now that I've had a chance to be with the new model for a little bit longer. Talk about password stuff. Also, an upgraded Apple Maps experience. Some changes Apple's making starting here in California. And we'll round things out with some Thunderbolt discussion and some apps to help you move your media to your iOS devices. So like I said, should be a pretty fun show, lots of things to cover. So I think we should just jump right in. But before we do that, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is OpsGenie. You know, we all hate it when our favorite website or service goes down, even for a few minutes. I know when it's something for me like Netflix or Amazon or, God forbid, iCloud, it has a huge impact on my life. I am a very unhappy customer at that point. I think we all get a little bit upset, but our unhappiness is really nothing compared to the impact that these outages have on businesses, the companies and services who go down. And luckily for us, there are those of you out there who are here to save us from these outages, the unsung heroes of companies, the dev and ops teams. And luckily for folks like you, there's OpsGenie by Atlassian. It's your job to actually respond quickly when these incidents happen. And to do that, you need a tool like OpsGenie in your utility belt. OpsGenie gives teams the power to respond quickly and efficiently to unplanned issues. It helps notify all the right people on your team through smart combination of scheduling and escalation paths that take into account things like time zones and holidays. So it doesn't matter where your people are or what their availability is. It can route issues to the right people at the right times. It allows for deep flexibility in how, when, and where your alerts are deployed. And it's supported by over 200 integrations like Jira, Amazon CloudWatch, Datadog, New Relic, and more. And it will track all activity and provide you useful insights to improve your future incident responses. With OpsGenie, your next incident doesn't stand a chance. Visit OpsGenie.com to sign up for a free company account and add up to 5 team members to that, all for free. Never miss a critical alert again with OpsGenie. Visit OpsGenie.com to sign up, and a big thank you to OpsGenie by Atlassian for their support of the MacCast. So iFixit has once again done its thing. They've been tearing down all of Apple's new products. I think we talked about the Mac Mini and the new MacBook Air. This past week, they took their knives and tools and heat guns to the iPad Pro. I think they broke down an 11-inch model, and there were a few surprises in there, a couple things here and there, not a ton of stuff. One big surprise was the sound system. They actually found 4 woofers and 4 tweeters inside there, so that accounts for the great sound that you can get from your iPad Pro. I think I mentioned in my review that the sound gets pretty loud to the point where I think it kind of rattles things a little bit. Mine feels like, I don't want to go as far as say distortion, but man, it gets loud and really uncomfortable. So a lot of sound can pump out of the new iPad, and obviously there's a reason for that. There's also a massive battery pack. It looked to me kind of like 2 ginormous cells in the middle, but they did note that those were attached with stretch-release battery tabs, which would make you think that it would be a little bit easier to swap out the batteries, but they also note that there's still a fair amount of glue holding those in. So it's kind of juries out on how easy it will be to swap out the battery in an iPad Pro. Obviously, for mere mortals like us, it's not something, you know, the average consumer can do. You're going to want an Apple authorized service center or Apple to do it for you. But looks like they've at least put a few mechanisms in there that might make it easier for those folks to do their jobs. They also broke down the Apple Pencil area, the charging port area, and also where the new USB-C port is, and they found those components to be modular. So that's a little bit of good news, meaning that it might be a little bit easier to repair those parts. And then they also tore down the Apple number 2 Pencil. And the interesting thing in there is they found what they believe is to be a capacitive grid kind of surrounding the central core of, you know, where the pencil components are. That would be the thing that would detect the new tap functionality that's built into the pencil. But the question comes, why would they need a grid? You know, just because right now the gestures are a simple double tap. There's just one gesture, so you would think you just need kind of a tap sensor there. The idea that there's a grid there means that maybe they can actually detect where you tap, not just how you're tapping, and could that possibly open up more functionality through a software update in the future? Apple hasn't given any indication of that, but with how the technology seems to be built in there, it seems like it may be a possibility. So that would be cool if that was something that that could happen. And that's pretty much all that they discovered in there that really looked a lot different. Of course, repairability score was still very low, a lot of glue, very hard to get in there. The thin screen and things like that make it a little bit hard to pry apart without potentially causing damage. They did note that the connector cables were far enough back that they didn't seem to pose a problem, but overall, it's pretty much what we've come to expect from an iPad teardown. The other thing kind of related to the iPad and the physical structure of it that was going on this week is another looming, and I hate to use this term, but it's the one that makes the most sense, a looming Bendgate controversy. I think it's been pretty much dispelled at this point by a lot in the media, because we know these things get sensationalized. It's been discovered that if you apply enough force to the aluminum, you know, that super strong metal, and the thin aluminum that's in the new iPad Pro's body, that guess what? They will bend. It does appear to kind of have some weak points, especially near where the pencil charging connector is, because, of course, they have to have radio transparency there. So there's a pretty nice pocket, you know, cut out there. You've got a little plastic piece. They've had to cut the structural side of the iPad to make that work. So, of course, that's going to be a weak point in the metal. There were also some unscientific drop tests that were done on various YouTube videos, and when dropped from a high enough height, it did appear that the aluminum would kind of crumple. I also did notice it seemed like, especially when dropped onto a hard surface like concrete, that the aluminum in the new iPads did have a tendency to sort of break up a little bit more, to kind of shred a little bit. And I have to wonder if that isn't a result a little bit of the new material. Apple made a big deal about the fact that the new iPads are 100% recycled aluminum. They're actually using the shavings in little metal metal particles, aluminum particles from the manufacturing of other Apple products and compositing that down into the casing for the new Mac Mini and the new iPad Pros along with the MacBook Air. So I don't know if that material is just reacts a little bit differently. But I mean, bottom line is you don't want to be dropping your iPad Pro because especially of the weight of the thing onto a concrete surface from a large height. So you're probably going to want to get a case on there. You know, is it going to bend in normal daily use? I don't think so. If you have it in a bag with heavily weighted stuff and you set it down in some way where it's going to have the ability to flex or bend, that might be a concern. So you're going to want to be careful about what you're putting it in with, especially if you're packing it for travel or something like that. So, you know, just like you would with any other iPad or any other piece of electronics, be careful with it. You know, even my MacBook Pro screen, I often worry about how flexible and bendable it is. It is aluminum. It's not a super tough metal. And inside the iPad, if you look at the iFixit teardown, it's basically just a giant frame. There's nothing really in the middle. You've got the batteries sitting in there, and they're taking up most of the space. The one thing I did kind of notice in that teardown is I guess Apple could have compartmentalized the batteries a little bit more, kind of gone with more cells and maybe put more structural aluminum inside the iPad. But I think they wanted to maximize space for the batteries. And again, in regular daily use, I don't see it being an issue. You want to be careful. You don't want to be sitting on your iPad or applying a lot of force to it because it could bend. Some other things that were tested this week, you know, by various YouTubers was scratching of the aluminum, the anodized aluminum. Yeah, if you take a knife to it or a sharp object, it is going to scratch. If you take sharp objects to the glass, it can scratch as well. It can also crack if you're putting heavy objects on it or, you know, tapping it with a hammer. Don't do those sorts of things, you know. So if you are worried about all this stuff, I would recommend getting a case for your iPad. I am using Apple's Folio case, and mine seems to be very well protected and just fine, although I don't plan on dropping it onto a concrete surface anytime soon. So, you know, just like you would with any other iPad, be careful with this stuff. It's an expensive piece of electronics. You want to handle it with care. So we're moving into the holiday season, which should be a big quarter for Apple. We've got a bunch of new products in the pipeline, including new iPhones and iPads and Macs. And you would think it would all be a great time for Apple financially. But analysts are a little bit down on what's going on with the iPhone XR. Starting off with analyst Ming-Chi Kuo, he lowered his predictions for 2019 on sales of the iPhone XR by 30%, down to about 70 million units, although he did not lower his fourth quarter estimates on total iPhone sales for all models. He still thinks that Apple's going to sell around 80 million units, though he thinks it's the legacy models that are going to kind of pick up the slack from the XS series, and specifically declines in what he expects the iPhone XR shipments to be in the holiday quarter, which is a little bit surprising to me. I still think the iPhone XR is going to do a little bit better than analysts are expecting. Now, why does Ming-Chi Kuo think these things? Well, he cites a few different reasons, including negative consumer confidence given a possible impending trade war between China and the United States. I guess I don't know how that factors into it. But also, he says customers might be choosing to wait another year for the iPhone XR for price drops and better features like dual cameras. So maybe a new model coming out and maybe a little bit of a pricing drop. So they're kind of indicating that, you know, this uptick in pricing by Apple might be kind of slowing consumer demand a little bit. And then he also cites potential competition from other phones from companies like Huawei, which is also doing a very expensive premium smartphone in the plus $1,000 range. So he does feel like the legacy models are going to continue to sell well into the holiday season and cites the more affordable price points. So I guess related to some of the conversations that we've been having here on the MacCast, has Apple pushed pricing too far? It's feeling like a lot of these analysts are feeling that may be the case. The other thing that is driving these predictions by analysts are a lot of stuff coming out of the supply chain. Now, supply chain can be really tricky to look at because depending upon how Apple did their ramp up for the phone models going in and component supplies and things like that, they can reach a point where they have saturation of components. They have enough that they need, and they start pulling back on orders. And so what's happening here is we're hearing a couple different companies in Apple's supply chain saying that they're revising their numbers and that they're getting order reductions from a major customer. Nobody's actually naming that customer, but it's not too far of a stretch to think that if it's impacting a company's bottom line this significantly, that that client could be Apple. So Lumentum, who supplies a Face ID component for Apple, came out this past week and said an unnamed customer had cut orders by 30%. Also, AMSAG out of Switzerland, a maker who provides the ambient light sensor for Apple, the one that's used for Face ID, also reduced their revenue projections for the fourth quarter of 2018 after a, quote, recent, or after, quote, recent demand changes from a major consumer customer. And also Japan Display had made similar reductions in outlooks for the fourth quarter. So those are all leading analysts to think that maybe iPhone XR, iPhone XS sales aren't going to be as strong as Apple originally predicted, and causing them to lower expectations for Apple in the fourth quarter and into 2019. Now, one possible contradiction to that is Apple's power management chip supplier, Dialog Semiconductor. They are saying they are not seeing a reduction in orders from Apple, but they do mention that their products are installed in a variety of Apple devices, so that does help. It's not just smartphones, and Apple does have some new products out on the market that would be using power management chips. So they say, you know, we have some products that get less volume and others are getting more volume. So that sort of balances things out. And it seems like many are feeling like Apple may have reached past the consumer price ceiling. And the question becomes, will upping the average selling price actually, you know, do okay for Apple moving forward? If they're selling fewer units, which many analysts are predicting, can they continue to balance that out with a higher average selling price? And some analysts think maybe, but some kind of feel like the party might be over at this point. They say despite higher average selling prices, they're still predicting about a 2% decline in iPhone revenue for 2019. So sales slowing to a point where Apple can't even stem the tide by upping prices. And I think part of that also might be, just based on reaction I'm getting from our community, that consumers have reached that point where enough is enough and we're saying this is too much and we're not going to be buying new products. We're going to be either holding on to our products longer, or many of you have even expressed to me that you might just find alternatives at this point to iPhones and iPads. And so we'll have to see how all of this plays out, but definitely all of it has caused Apple's stock price to take a hit this week, and it's all due to this analyst speculation over future iPhone unit sales. Really, unit sales seems to be the thing that they're focusing on, and ultimately, though, it really should be focused on revenues, right? And there is a glimmer of hope when it comes to Apple's revenues, even in the face of declining iPhone unit sales, and that is Apple's services business. Analysts are still expecting that part of Apple's business to grow almost 20% in revenue next year. And the idea is that more revenue will be coming from Apple's loyal customers and large base of installed devices. So even if we're buying less devices, we're buying them less frequently or opting for lower cost options like older models, that still means Apple has a lot of devices out in the marketplace, and those are all devices they can sell services into, services like Apple Music, iCloud, Apple Care, and their new upcoming video service. And all of that is expected to drive future growth. And the other thing about services is services are almost pure revenue. So they generate a lot more revenue than even high price point, say iPhones or other devices with a high average selling price. In fact, Morgan Morgan Stanley analyst Katie Huberty points out that with the smartphone market growth as a whole slowing, services offer, quote, more stable growth and higher margins. So Apple may still be able to weather this storm when it comes to investors. The question becomes, in the short term, how are they going to handle and manage that? But ultimately, you know, I think Apple is going to be just fine. It is an interesting time, though, with Apple raising prices and seeing the consumer reaction. I think analysts and people on Wall Street are getting a little bit nervous, and we're seeing that reflected in Apple's stock price. One other thing related to iPhone news this week that I just didn't have any place else to fit in the news is the iPhone XR, because we are talking about iPhone XR sales. The iPhone XR is now available SIM-free in the U.S., so if you were waiting for that, it is out and available. And just one last comment on all of this. I still do think that the iPhone XR is an amazing product in Apple's lineup. I think it is the phone that if people are looking to upgrade, that most people are going to opt in for. I just have a feeling it's going to take a while longer for us to see demand for iPhone XR. I think it's going to be spread out over a longer period of time. But ultimately, I think that's going to result in very good sales numbers for iPhone XR. And I still think a lot of these analysts are underestimating how well the iPhone XR will do. I think it's going to, at the end of the day, turn out to be a much better product for Apple, even in terms of unit sales. I think unit sales are going to stay relatively flat, if not grow a little bit, whereas I think a lot of analysts are expecting it to go down in 2019. But we'll just have to wait and see who's right on that. And if you do have opinions or thoughts on it, shoot us an email, maccast@gmail.com. Apple has confirmed with The Verge that some repairs of Macs that contain the T2 security chip do require service centers to run a special tool or a piece of software from Apple called Apple's AST2 system configuration software before the machine will become completely operational. Apple only acknowledged the existence and need for the tool actually on some repairs and did not provide to The Verge a list of the repairs that required the software, nor which devices specifically were affected. You may remember this story from about a month ago. We had reports of the tool's existence. It was due to a leaked repair document distributed to Apple authorized service providers. The document there specifically noted the need for the tool on repairs for things like the Touch ID module or the logic board, and it caused a little bit of a stir because it means that, you know, non-authorized third-party companies would potentially not be able to do some repairs on Apple's newer Macs with the T2 security chip. Now, I personally don't really see this as a huge issue because, again, it does mean that just non-Apple authorized repair centers would not be able to have access to the software or perform these kinds of repairs. But I think that my advice to most people would be that you always want to use an Apple authorized service provider or Apple to get your repairs done anyway. I guess maybe for older products or as these products age out a bit, you might want to have it opened up and have more options for service available to you. But specifically when you're under AppleCare or an AppleCare warranty, you really do want to use an Apple authorized provider for your repairs. So, and this software is presumably made available to those Apple authorized repair centers, and of course Apple itself has access to it. So not a huge deal here, but it has been confirmed by Apple that, you know, for certain repairs you will need to run, or the repair center rather will need to run, this system configuration software. There are some new MacBook Pro options up and available on Apple's website. As promised in a press release after Apple's October media event, Apple said they were going to be updating the MacBook Pro, the 15-inch MacBook Pro with touch bars, with new graphics processor options. actually AMD Radeon Pro Vega graphics. Now you can order those from Apple's website. They are offering two choices, the Radeon Pro Vega 16 with 4 gigabytes of HBM2 memory. That'll cost you an extra $250 on the price of your 15-inch MacBook Pro. And the other option is the Radeon Pro Vega 20 with 4 gigabytes of memory for $350 extra. Apple says the new GPUs will offer up to 60% faster graphics performance versus the previous generation top-end option, the Radeon Pro 560X. These new units with GPUs appear to be shipping starting on November 20th, so if you order them up now, that's about the soonest you can get it, and they look like some great options, and the price seems not too bad to me. So if you're looking for the highest performance MacBook Pro you can get those available now with some snazzy new GPUs in them. And one other bit of quick news related to Apple's online sales. Unfortunately, it looks like the AirPort Extreme and the 2 terabyte AirPort Time Capsule have been finally removed from Apple's online store this week. Apple ended development of the AirPort line, you may remember, back in April, but they did say that they planned to continue selling the existing stock until that supply was exhausted. Well, it's looking like we have finally reached that point because Apple did pull that down, or those two items down, from their online sales this week. So no more AirPort Extreme, no more Time Capsules available from Apple. I would presume that you could probably still find some units out through third-party resellers, but it is going to get harder and harder to find. So if you are a fan, you probably want to stock up and squirrel away some of those for the future. But, you know, at this point, I think there are a lot of great third-party router options. I'm particularly partial to the ones from Synology. The 2600 AC router will likely be my next router. And now there are also a bunch of great offerings of network-attached storage drives that do support Time Machine over the network. And I actually use a Synology for that, but you've got options from Western Digital and Drobo and a bunch of other companies. So, you know, I don't think the market has been left high and dry, but it is kind of sad to see the end of an era, the end of the AirPort era, because Apple did make some great networking products. And who knows, maybe they'll, just like they did with Apple displays, they'll reconsider that at some point. But for now, they are out of that business. And finishing up the news for this week, a little bit of entertainment news. Variety says that indie entertainment studio A24 is going to make a, quote, slate of films and TV shows for Apple. There weren't a lot of details other than that, but they did say that the two companies have reached a multi-year agreement for multiple films. In case you're unfamiliar with A24, the studio is known for films like Moonlight, Room, Ex Machina, and Lady Bird, all great films and many Oscar winners or nominees, so they're producing some quality stuff. The studio also has deals with DirecTV and Amazon, and this Apple deal would be in addition to those. The deals with DirecTV and Amazon, though, are for distribution rights and for carrying films after they hit theaters, so it's not clear if the arrangement with Apple is the same, if these are films that will be distributed exclusively through Apple's upcoming new video service, or if it's more like the Amazon deal where A24 will continue to produce the movies, then Apple will get rights to have those in their video service once they hit theaters and have a theatrical release. But either way, another kind of big win for Apple's original video content, grabbing a great studio and producer and creator of great film content. And I just get more and more excited about the service, especially now that it's pretty much believed that it will be free to all customers who already own an Apple product, and that you would buy premium channels and other services through the Apple TV app, and that's how Apple would continue to make additional revenue for that service. So kind of all of Apple's content is the, hey, let's bring a bunch of people in, get eyeballs for free, and then kind of upsell them on other content. So Apple really kind of, in a way, in my mind, becoming almost like a cable company, where, or even better, it's more like the older days of TV, where you would just pay for premium cable channels, but you got kind of all the basic stuff for free. So Apple kind of becoming the basic entertainment service, and then you would buy premium services on top of that. And if they can pull that sort of thing off, that's going to be pretty interesting to see them do. And I am personally getting very excited about it, because a lot of this content just seems like really good, well-produced stuff, and I can't wait for it to hit. It's supposed to happen sometime in 2019, and I say bring it on. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another couple show sponsors, starting with CashFly. You know, when websites don't load, we lose interest. And each second a page takes to load, it costs a company about 16% in engagement. And fewer visits means fewer customers. And ultimately, that's not really good for anyone. So that's why CashFly has your back with their new web optimization capabilities. All of your content will be optimized before it's delivered to your visitors without requiring any development effort from you. And with the recent addition of CashFly's flexible Edge application platform and implementation services, their capabilities reach far beyond those of any traditional CDN. CashFly's web content optimization solution includes powerful APIs for solving content distribution problems, on-the-fly next-gen image optimization, application load balancing, and smart asset delivery. Listen, if your website is directly tied to your revenue, and you know it is, optimize your site's content. Do it now. Guarantee the best user experience for all of your customers, no matter where they are or whatever device they're using. And you can do that today. The good people at CashFly are even going to provide a free optimization consultation for listeners of this podcast. That's right, just for you, a free optimization consultation from CashFly. Know exactly where your website stands today with a Lighthouse score report, and learn how CashFly's web optimization solution can add 60 points instantly to your score. To do that, visit mac.cashfly.com. That's mac.cashefly.com to get your free optimization consultation from CashFly. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. I'd also like to thank LinkedIn Marketing Solutions for their support. You know, I'm a LinkedIn user because it has a unique position among my social networks. It's specifically where I go to find and make connections for my business and for my professional career. It's where you go when you might want to find a job or locate a new supplier or partner or expand your professional network. So if you're looking to market your business, why wouldn't you choose to market where your audience is already hanging out to engage in business-related stuff? It's all about marketing to who matters. And LinkedIn is the world's largest professional network. So if you're looking to drive brand awareness, to generate leads, and to build long-term purposeful relationships, their network of more than 575 million members provides the perfect place for you to target your message. And reaching the right audience means you're going to get high-quality leads that can increase your website's traffic and increase your brand awareness. Targeting is also critically important, and LinkedIn has the marketing tools to help you target your customers with precision, down to the job title, company name, and industry. And with LinkedIn, you're also given access to the right kinds of leads. In fact, 4 out of 5 customers who are on LinkedIn are the decision makers at their companies. So you are building relationships with the consumers that really matter. And best of all, if you want to try out LinkedIn, they're going to give you a free $100 ad credit. So to redeem your free $100 LinkedIn ad credit and launch your first campaign, go to linkedin.com/maccast. That's linkedin.com/maccast for your free $100 ad credit. Terms and conditions apply. And a big thank you to LinkedIn Marketing Solutions for their support of the Maccast. We've been having a lot of conversations here on the Maccast over the last couple of weeks, as you probably know, about Apple and their decision to kind of increase prices on a lot of their products. And it's making a lot of folks in the Apple community not too thrilled. And I totally agree. You know, no one is happy when they have to pay more for something. And we've been talking about maybe a lot of the reasons why or why not Apple is doing it, and or why they should or shouldn't be doing it, and just our general feelings about it. And I am very mixed about it. I understand why they're doing it from a business perspective. I hate it as an Apple customer that I'm having to shell out a lot more for products that were already very expensive. We already pay premium prices, and now we're having to pay even more premium prices. And we talked a little bit about some of the things that Apple also takes away, and what starts to feel a little bit like maybe nickel and diming, you know, things like not including a cable in a box, just little tiny things, right? But at the end of the day, when you've got a company that is making billions and, you know, valued at trillions of dollars, it gets a little bit hard to understand those decisions. And, you know, I just, that got me thinking about sort of how Apple is pricing things. Are we really paying more? Have we always paid a lot? And a lot of you are thinking about these things too, because I got a lot of feedback from people on both sides of this conversation. I know some of you feeling like this is too far. Apple's taken things, you know, over the line, and I am not going to take it anymore. I'm either not going to buy this year's round of products because I don't feel that they're worth it. And we've talked a lot about, you know, that value proposition that each of us has to decide: is Apple delivering the value in the products for the prices that they're asking? For me personally, I think the value is still there. I don't like paying a little bit more, but I will pay a little bit more so that I can have that quality, continue to have the kinds of service and reliability that I've come to know and love. And it's a lot of the reason why I'm an Apple customer. But it did get me thinking that, you know, it's always been expensive to be an owner of Apple products. And with Apple's many kind of custom configuration options now, I think part of the issue is not so much the total cost of the products, but that especially for Mac products, when you see things like, wow, this RAM is costing me X amount more, and this solid state drive is 2 to 3 times more expensive than maybe what I could get off the street. And yes, I've compared prices of PCI, NVMe, you know, the high-end, high-quality stuff that Apple is charging. When you go into their configuration options, their build-to-order options, and you start building out a machine moving away from the base price, which doesn't seem so bad, right? The starting at price that Apple has delivered seems good, but you start to custom configure it and the price goes up exponentially. And it's not so much that the price is going up exponentially, I think. It's more that you can see that cost of each purchase decision that you're making, right? You're deciding, well, I really need 16 gigabytes of RAM or 32 gigabytes of RAM. And you're seeing directly that, wow, that's adding $400, $500, $600 to the base price of that thing that I want to buy. Or worse, with the storage options, you know, you could be adding $1,200 onto that base price. And that really becomes this kind of hard pill to swallow. But it is a little bit different than like the old days when you would price out an Apple computer. Yeah, they had different configurations and different options, but they kind of just gave you a price, right? They didn't really componentize it out. Is that even a word? They didn't break it out kind of like that. I guess they've been doing it for a long time, but I think you're seeing my point here is that, you know, really what I think we need to be doing is pricing the whole widget, the whole thing that we want, and then deciding, is the value there? And for example, I'll just take my current 15-inch MacBook Pro. I have the top-of-the-line 15-inch MacBook Pro, the 2.0 from 2015, 2.8 gigahertz i7 processor. It's a quad-core, four-core processor, 16 gigabytes of RAM, and a 1 terabyte hard drive. So it was the highest-end base configuration that you could buy from Apple. And I think it cost, if I'm remembering right, $31.99 or $32.99. And so I thought, you know, if I had to replace this in 2018, what would I buy? And what would that cost? And if I took the same spec 2018 model, so the highest end processor that Apple offers currently on a 15-inch MacBook Pro, which is the 2.9 gigahertz i9 6-core processor, and then added in the things that would bring it up to 16 gigabytes of RAM and a 1 terabyte. And 1 terabytes of storage, the price for that model would be $3,499. So yes, about $200 more expensive than the thing that I bought in 2015. And actually, I really picked it up in 2017. Then, you know, that's not a huge price increase. And I am getting a bit more in terms of processor, right? That i9, the 2.9 gigahertz i9 with 6 cores is a significant bump up from my 2.8 i7 with 4 cores. And so, you know, when you start looking at it that way, you go, yeah, it's a little bit of a price increase, but it's not a huge one. And that's what I paid before, and I'm paying a little bit more now. But you could even argue cost of inflation, some other things, right? So it starts to maybe not look as bad. It's still dang expensive, and I'm not going to deny that. I probably could go maybe configure a PC with a similar processor and similar RAM, but are all the other components going to be the same or as high quality? I could also do some tweaks and configurations to what I'm buying from Apple, and I probably could wind up with a machine that actually costs less than what I paid for my current machine. And maybe I don't need a 2.9 6-core i9. Maybe I could get the i5 configuration or the i7 configuration, and it would work just fine for me. I would argue actually it would. I really don't need this much processor. I probably don't use that much of it, especially considering I do just an audio podcast. But, you know, that's here nor there. The point I'm trying to get to here is we maybe need to start looking at, you know, X amount of RAM costs Y, or oh my God, $600 extra for the extra 768 gigabytes of storage that I want to move from, you know, 128 to 1 terabyte of storage, and get to the point where we're pricing the whole system that we need and sort of comparing prices that way. And I think it becomes a little bit easier to understand or to see what the price differences are when you start looking at it that way. So just another quick example, you know, if I was buying a machine, I would want similar specs to what I have. So that is, again, some sort of Mac with 16 gigabytes of RAM and 1 terabyte of storage. And so I priced out all of Apple's different offerings, both desktop and notebook, with those specs, starting with kind of the base level models and not really looking as much at processor or GPU, because for me, those things don't matter as much. It might be different for you, but I think you understand the point. So a MacBook Air would be about $2,600, and that's with a 1.5 terabyte drive because they don't have a 1 terabyte option. A 13-inch MacBook Pro, $2,600. A 15-inch MacBook Pro, and this would be the 2.2 gigahertz 6-core i7, which again would still be a jump up from what I have, $2,999. So I'd actually save a little bit of money versus what I bought this year. A 1 terabyte Mac Mini, $1,899. And a 27-inch iMac, $2,699. So all within kind of the same price point, give or take a couple $100, the Mac Mini being the cheapest option, the 15-inch MacBook Pro being the most expensive, but all in that $2,600 to $3,000 range, which I found very, very interesting. And again, I could play around with my processor needs. I might be able to get that price down a little bit. But that says to me, you know, my cost of ownership, my cost of using a Mac as my computer every year is going to be, or every time I want to upgrade, is going to be around that price point. And I think if you start thinking about it that way, it becomes a little less shocking when you get to the point where you need to upgrade, right? You can start to budget for that. You can start to work around that. And that's not to excuse or to say that Apple isn't charging maybe too much for their storage or they're charging too much for their RAM. It's more just looking at it as this is what it costs to be a Mac owner. And if I don't like that, maybe it's time for me to start looking at other options. As much as I hate to say that, you know, I am a huge Apple fan. I'm not planning on switching anytime soon, but I know for some of you, this becomes critical. You don't have that kind of money to spend. There also is that other option, though, that we've been talking about, which is you just hang on to the thing that you have, you know, for a little bit longer. And I really do find that I am able to use my older computers for longer than I have been in the past. Yes, we've always gotten good longevity out of our Apple products, but I think it really is extending. It used to be you get to the point where the operating system wouldn't work anymore, and Apple has done a pretty good job of continuing to not only support older machines, but also improve performance as they upgrade the OS and continue to provide new features and functionality and all those sorts of things. So I guess the difference is like, it's not that I can hold on to a machine longer. It's that I feel like I don't need to upgrade my machine. And a lot of times when I'm upgrading my machine, I'm doing it more because I want to, not because I need to. And so I think if you don't have the money or the budget, I do kind of feel more and more these days you're going to be okay holding on to that older system. And you can do a couple little tweaks and things, maybe get an external SSD and boot off of that if you can't put an SSD in internally and get even more longevity out of that machine. So that's just some of the stuff that I've been thinking about this week. I know you might be having your own thoughts about it. So if you want to send me some feedback, shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. One other thing kind of somewhat related to this, and I was thinking about this as well, when I was thinking about these configurations and this idea of sort of pricing the whole machine versus pricing out all the individual upgrades and things like that, I kind of felt like maybe Apple should be moving back toward just, hey, here's some base configurations, let's not do the custom configurations anymore, and we'll just give you one price if you want the Mac with this processor and these components, this is the price, and kind of go back to that good, better, best option, you know, where you just have three models to choose from, and that's what you pick out of, and you don't do a lot of this custom configuration. And I know that'll probably upset some people who really like to tweak and kind of build their own system, but, you know, I can see Apple moving back toward that place. And Jason Snell posted a really interesting piece over at Macworld. I'll link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. And he was kind of looking at, you know, what happens when Apple moves to their own processors, which we're thinking they're going to do for Macs. And he was looking at the MacBook Air as kind of an example, right? The MacBook Air this year only has a single processor option. You can't opt for different processors. And so when you're configuring it, you're really just choosing between RAM and storage. And he kind of drew a parallel to the iPad. And I'll go even further and draw the parallel to iPhones, where with Apple's A series processor, you don't choose the processor. You also don't choose the RAM and you don't choose the GPU. Really, your only option is how much storage am I getting? And then Apple makes the decision about the GPU and the CPU and the processor and how all of those are going to work together. And the operating system is optimized for it. And they give you the best processor that they can give you. It's not like you start out with a base level processor and then move up to, depending upon your model, you know, the quad core or six core i9. So you don't start with an i3 and then move up to an i9. You just get the A12. And the A12 is the best possible processor that Apple can make that year. And I guess in this year's models, they did tweak the RAM a little bit depending upon how much storage you get. But beyond that, no, they choose the GPU and everything else. You choose a screen size and you choose a storage, right? Or a form factor, let's just call it, right? Depending upon your iPad, you know, which size screen do you want, or your iPhone? Do you want the big one or do you want the small one? But they all come exactly with the same processor. They don't do this difference there. And it would be interesting moving forward, especially when Apple goes into building Macs with their own processor if they took a similar approach, right? You just got the top of the line Apple processor in every Mac across the board, and every model of, say, the MacBook Pro. And then your only decision would be, do I want a 13-inch or a 15-inch, and how much storage do I want? And that would set the price different, but all other factors would be the same. And you might be going, well, that's crazy, because I want to be able to pick, to upgrade to the better GPU or to the better CPU. And the point here would be you would have the top of the line across the board, just like you do with an iPhone, right? There's no difference between the processor and the GPU that's in the $700 iPhone XR versus the $1,099 XS Max, right? The difference between those models are, the cameras, it's other components. But for raw processing power, you are getting exactly the same device. And that could be an interesting approach for Macs moving forward. And I kind of like that idea. It sounds very interesting to me. Apple making the custom configuration thing something of the past. And I will just point out, for those of you who don't know, some of us have been around long enough to know, Apple didn't even do this custom configuration thing until the mid-90s, when they actually bought Power Computing. About the time that Steve Jobs came back to Apple, or a little bit after the time that Steve Jobs came back to Apple and killed the licensing program, they bought out Power Computing. And the main reason they bought out Power Computing was Power Computing had this great online system for custom configuring builds and components. And that's when that got rolled into Apple's online ordering system, or what ultimately became Apple's online ordering system. You used to have to go into a retail store or go through an authorized reseller to buy your Apple products. You didn't go directly to Apple. So that all came on board then, and that's when this whole custom configuration thing came on board. And I'm thinking, maybe it's time for that to go away, right? Why not? Why not just have the best processor, the best GPU, coupled with the operating system for the optimal performance in every Mac that you buy? And then really what you're configuring and you're paying for is a larger screen, maybe a little bit better camera, some other components, maybe different ports. I don't know what the different options would be, but they wouldn't be centered around that sort of basic processor GPU algorithm. So I don't know. What do you think about that? I think I would welcome less choice if those choices were coming with the kinds of performance that we're seeing from, say, a product like the iPad. Any iPad you buy is going to be amazing in terms of running software and applications. It's going to be the best device that Apple can deliver at whatever price point you choose to pay for it. And that sounds really appealing to me. And that may be a way to claw back or get back from, this price increase and Apple kind of charging too much or people feeling like Apple's charging too much for what they are delivering. But I don't know. What are your thoughts on this? Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Now I want to follow up a little bit on iPad Pro feedback. The Apple's new iPad Pros are hitting the market. Some of you have them. I have a new 11-inch iPad Pro, and I asked you to provide some feedback. And regular listener and contributor Gary did not disappoint. So here's what Gary thought about the new iPad Pro.
Hey, Adam, Gary. I wanted to share with you a little bit about what I'm thinking on the new iPad Pros. I think that's right. iPad Pros? iPads Pro. I think that's the right way. Or the Apple way. So I do have the Apple 12.9-inch iPad Pro, and it is the first generation unit, which does work well. I have the Apple Pencil, and I have the Apple Keyboard, or the Keyboard Folio piece on here. I did also add the Lightning to USB-C, because I believe the initial charger that came with it was, I think, the 12-watt, like super slow for what was needed to charge this iPad. So I ended up adding quite a bit of accessories to it to get it to where it needs to be. And I did go to the Apple Store and take a look at the new iPads. My initial thoughts were while they seem so much smaller. The 11-inch almost looks to me like it's the 9.7-inch size, even though I think the screen is quite a bit larger. It's just, it seems the same size. And maybe it is. It didn't seem to me a good replacement to my current 12.9-inch, which I'd use generally as a 40%, maybe 30% workflow from my MacBook Pro, where I take it with me. The iPad 12.9-inch that has had its bezels removed and the screen size is the same seems a lot smaller, which is nice that it is a more small size. I almost kind of want it to be bigger with a bigger screen. That way we have that much more to see. But I really did like the feel of that unit. It felt very well balanced. It felt like it was a substantial piece. It almost seemed easier to hold on to. I don't know why that initially is. Maybe the metal was not as slippery as the regular 12.9, which I did bring it with me. The Apple Pencil, though, was kind of pretty amazing compared to the current iPad Pencil. It is better weighted in your hand, and the other pencil, it seemed like it was very back-end heavy, so when you're using it, it just felt like it's tugging down on your hand quite a bit. This other one, I think, is a little bit shorter. Maybe I should really have measured, but it was shorter and more lightweight and easier to use. So I really did like that. The one big thing that I kind of saw there that I wasn't sure what was going on, felt unusual, is there were no applications other than what comes stock on an iPad loaded on the iPad Pro in the store, which kind of made me think, is this incomplete? Did they not set these up all the way? Or were they intentionally not wanting people to see or use them with those extra apps? Like normally they have a demo of Procreate, or they have different demos of different softwares where we can kind of see more on how they operate. There wasn't a good way to compare from my 12.9 to that. I did watch a few different YouTube videos on people kind of showing that the software really hasn't caught up to the processing speed of the new units. So thought that was interesting. I am very excited about an opportunity to move to a platform like that because they do seem really great. I don't think it's a market for me right now because having put so much money already into the iPad Pro with the pencil, with the keyboard, with the extra battery, or not battery, the charger, it's quite a lot of money. And I think the recycle rate from Apple is $250. So you take a $1,000 unit down to $250, doesn't work for me. So, but maybe there'll be an opportunity out there someday. Thanks.
Hey, Gary, thank you. I appreciate your comments as always and some great insights there. And I agree with a lot of what you're saying. Just a couple comments from me. I will let you know the pencil is shorter for sure because it lacks the cap that covers the lightning connector. So you don't have the lightning connector sticking out and you don't have the cap. So it's that much shorter, the Apple number 2 pencil versus the Apple pencil. I have also noticed some issues with apps that have not been updated yet, although not performance issues. I hadn't even heard that people were noticing performance issues or apps that weren't optimized for the new processor. What I'm noticing mostly is screen size stuff. A lot of my apps are just not optimized for the new screen. So like, for example, Reader, my RSS reading app, has a big blank spot on the left-hand side, or until recently, because Netflix just updated it, Netflix didn't go all the way edge to edge. So I sort of had this pillboxing. I might have mentioned that on the previous episode of the MacCast. So little things like that, nothing really major. It kind of feels like the time when we had, you know, like 2X apps, if you remember that, instead of full iPad apps. And that was kind of the workaround, and it was pretty awful. But we made it through, and then ultimately developers upgraded their apps. And it looks like a lot of developers are quickly updating their apps for the new iPads. So I don't think that's going to be a big long-term issue. I will tell you, coming from the 12.9-inch first-generation iPad to the 11-inch iPad Pro, the latest version. I'm not really liking some things about the smaller form factor. And so I will agree with you on that. If you do have a 12.9-inch iPad Pro currently, you're probably going to want to stick with that size if you're happy with it. If you're totally feeling like, oh man, this thing is massive and cumbersome and I don't like it, then I think the 11-inch probably is the perfect size. But just so people understand what I'm not liking about it, first and foremost is probably the on-screen keyboard. One of the nice things about the on-screen keyboard on the 12.9-inch is it's a big full keyboard and it has extra keys like the number keys across the top, and those are non-existent on the smaller model. I had sort of forgotten about that, and so it's really like working on a compact one. The best analogy I have for you is it would be like going from an extended desktop keyboard and using that every day and then having to move to a compact one. So that is taking a lot of getting used to. It's a lot of extra taps when I'm using the on-screen keyboard because I have to either, you know, swipe down or use the little swipe down gesture on the keys to get to the extra characters, or I have to go to the secondary keyboard. And so it's a little less efficient when I'm typing on screen. I will also tell you it's a similar situation for the Smart Folio keyboard, because I do have the Smart Folio keyboard, and it has a compact key orientation as well, and that was wider and bigger with the 12.9-inch iPad Pro. So getting used to that, that's taking a little bit of getting used to. And one thing that I thought was going to be better, but I'm not so convinced, is with the prior generation Folio keyboard, when you would fold it around and you were using it on a table as the keyboard, one of the complaints was that the surface that normally sits against the screen would then be sitting on the surface of your table. And of course, that means it's probably getting dirty and you're going to fold it around and you're going to put that dirt against your screen. And so it seemed like Apple addressed that problem with the new design, because with the new design, when you fold it and are using it in keyboard mode, the outside cover of the iPad is sitting down on the table. Now, the problem with that is when you keep the keyboard cover on and you flip it around to use it as a tablet, now with the new keyboard design, you're actually holding on to the keys. The part with the keys is sitting out, and when you go to set it down on a table or a surface, the part with the keys is sitting down on the surface of the table. And I don't know which is better. I can tell you it feels really weird when I have to use it in tablet mode. And you know, while removing the cover with the magnets is relatively easy, there's not really a good place to put it down. You know, like using it that way is not really conducive. The way you want to use it is you want to leave the cover on, flip it around, and use it like a tablet. It is a little weird to be pressing against the keys as you're doing that. Now, luckily, it's smart enough and the detection is really good, that to the point that when it's flipped all the way around, it's not detecting any key presses. Nothing's happening. The on-screen keyboard still activates and all that sort of thing. So I don't have any problems there. It's just a weird feeling. And, I don't know how else to describe it other than that. And I'm not sure how I feel about that. But finally, getting to your comments about, you know, not feeling like you are going to upgrade or need to upgrade, I completely agree with you there. What's interesting about the iPads, and just again, this is a testament, I think, to Apple's ability to make the software work great and continue to work with the older processors and just design processors that are amazingly good and perform really well for a very long time. I think unless you are the type of person that must have always the latest and greatest Apple product, or you have a specific need for a new iPad Pro, if you have an older generation, there is very little reason to upgrade. And I think that's actually a good thing. I don't think that's a problem. I think a lot of Mac fans feel like it's a problem because you want to have the latest, coolest stuff, right? Apple changed the design so this one looks cooler. It's smaller if you have the 12.9-inch, and that seems really appealing. But you can't really justify it, the price, because you're not going to gain that much in productivity. And so that's the thing you have to focus on, is that I have a really good iPad already and I don't need to upgrade. And that is awesome. You know, the new models, I think, are a really nice evolution And for those looking to upgrade or to get into iPad Pro for the first time, it's going to be an amazing purchase. But outside of that, I don't think you need to worry too much. It's nice. And I think that's nice because it means current owners don't have to feel like they're really missing out on anything, especially considering, like you said, you've already made a massive investment in terms of accessories and other sorts of things. So don't feel like you have to upgrade. I guess that's the message I'm giving to people is don't feel like you're missing out on something in this upgrade, because I have to tell you, in day-to-day usage, other than the size differences, everything else is little niceties, the Apple Pencil, not having to, charge it by plugging it into the end, which is always weird, but really not a big deal. The Apple Pencil more or less works the same. The iPad itself more or less works the same. The operating system works exactly the same between my first generation iPad Pro and this one. So, don't feel bad if you're not able, willing, or don't want to upgrade. And just one last thing, by the way, if you were going to upgrade because you ultimately decide, I'm a huge Apple fanboy, I want to have the latest and greatest, I just need to have it, you're much better off selling your first generation current model than turning it into Apple for the recycle fee. I mean, they're giving you next to nothing for that recycle fee. You should be able to get for your current first generation model iPad Pro somewhere in the range of 500, maybe 600 bucks. I've been pricing them out on eBay. That seems to be what they're going for. And you add in the accessories and you might even be able to get more. So, sell it. Don't have it recycled. There's a lot of value still in that first generation iPad Pro. And I'm sure there's someone out there that will give you a fair amount of money for that. If not, pass it down, hand it down to somebody who's going to really appreciate it. Don't let your old Apple products go to the graveyard before their time, I guess is what I'm saying. I think Apple actually turns around and resells them on the secondary market, like a company like Gazelle or somebody else would do. So I don't think I don't think they end up in a landfill. But again, you can get more money for it than Apple is willing to give you for it. So just be aware of that. But thank you for your feedback. And anybody else out there who wants to provide feedback on any of the new Apple products, shoot us an email, maccast@gmail.com. Let's talk a little bit about passwords and password managers. I think all of us at one point in our lives, or maybe currently, are guilty about probably not using good password and password management policies or techniques, right? We all have those passwords that we've used in either now or in the past that are probably not up to snuff. And I am a big fan of password managers and two-factor authentication. I learned about that the hard way because long, long time ago, I had my Yahoo account get hacked and it was not fun. Let me just say that. And so I don't think we need to go into the lectures about why you should be using a password manager, why you should be making sure that every password you use on every website is a different password and all those sorts of things. I think we've covered that thoroughly here on the MacCast in the past. If you'd like me to go deeper into that, shoot me some feedback and tell me that, and we can maybe revisit that thing. But this week, I want to talk to you about something that came up from a listener who sent me an email, listener Michael, and he just pointed out a possible another good reason to be using a password manager. There's lots of reasons, but this one is as protection from ransomware and ransom scams and blackmail, which is something that has been going on. You may have received one of these emails, maybe you haven't, but basically what hackers are doing is they will buy or trade compromised account lists. So, data breaches that we hear about every day, different companies, their password databases getting hacked and those sorts of things. This is why you want to use a separate password and log in on every website. But those lists, they get cracked and broken and then they get shared around. And so what these hackers are doing now is they're buying those lists, they're taking the emails and emailing people threatening emails and saying that, hey, I've hacked your accounts, I have access to your computer, I've gotten remote control, I'm tapping into your iSight camera, your video camera, and I'm filming you doing things that you wouldn't want people to know that you're doing when you're in your house. I've dug through your computer and your folders and your iCloud accounts, and I have compromising data and images of you, and I'm going to expose these to your friends and your family and your boss and your coworkers and embarrass you unless you pay me a ransom. You got to pay me this amount of money. You need to send it to me, usually in Bitcoin. Otherwise, I am going to expose you. I'm going to ruin your life. And as proof that they know about you or have access to your accounts and stuff, what they will do is they will tell you your password. And it's usually a password that you've used because, again, they've got it from one of these compromised lists, right? So it is your password. It is legitimate data. Potentially, hopefully, you know, you've known about the compromise and you've changed all your passwords since then, but maybe you haven't, or maybe it's some old password. And what Michael pointed out, it was he received one of these emails recently and he knew it wasn't the case, but what he was able to do was go through, and because he used a different password or different passwords on every website, he was able to take the password that they gave him and sort of reverse engineer it through his password manager and find out which service or which account had been data breached. And in this case, it turned out to be an old account that he hadn't used in a really, really long time. It was for some inconsequential thing, but it was able to give him that peace of mind that, hey, I don't need to worry about this. I've already changed that password. This is some weird account, and this is totally bogus, and they don't have anything on me. So that was kind of a nice little benefit of using a password manager. And, you know, typically these days too, when an account becomes compromised, we do get notified, especially with things like GDPR, but not always, right? And so having this ability to kind of reverse engineer that information is kind of nice. And so just another great reason to use a password manager. And the other thing I will point out somewhat related to this is a lot of password managers these days, 1Password, for example, they have some great tools for helping you find and identify potential passwords and accounts that may have been compromised so that you can easily go through and update those accounts. So it's another great benefit of having all your passwords in a password manager. The tool for 1Password is called Watchtower, and they tell you in advance which services have accounts that have been either compromised or hacked. They show you compromised, vulnerable passwords based on the Have I Been Pwned website. It'll show you reused passwords. So what accounts are you using the same password on? You probably want to go change all of those. Where do you have weak passwords? Which websites are unsecured? And which accounts have two-factor authentication available, but where you haven't activated it yet? And so this tool can be really, really helpful for just managing and cleaning up your passwords. And so I encourage you to go in and use those features. Now, you don't have to go crazy, but I think this can help. I did this and, you know, I noticed a couple things. One, I have a lot of passwords for my clients because I'm a web developer. I often have to get into their systems, and a lot of my clients have very insecure and bad passwords. They also have passwords on services and accounts that have been hacked. So I'm able to go through and just warn them and talk to them and have a conversation about using better passwords and better password management. A lot of times they don't follow that advice and there's nothing I can do about it, but at least I can use these tools to maybe help them. But I also was able to go through and look at some of my compromised or vulnerable passwords and determine, you know, have I changed those? Are they out of date? Do I need to go change them? It also helped me identify and clean out a lot of old accounts, right? A lot of those old bad passwords are on accounts that I set up a long time ago. I don't use anymore. So I was able to go back to those services if they still existed and just delete and tell them to remove those accounts and remove my data and just kind of clean that stuff up. And then I could take those passwords out of my password manager. So there are a lot of great reasons to use a password manager beyond just, you know, sort of organizing and managing your passwords. They have a lot of great features and tools, so I encourage you to go out and check them out. You know, 1Password is a popular one. There's LastPass. I know some of you probably use some other ones that I'm not familiar with. If you have a suggestion, shoot us an email, maccast@gmail.com. At this point, if you are an Apple fan, you may or may not be aware that Apple has been working on improving Apple Maps. You know, they've taken a lot of flack in the past for the quality of Apple Maps. They have been often compared to Google and come up short. And recently, Apple has decided, and by recently I mean within the last few years, Apple has decided that they are really going to double down and invest in maps. And as part of that effort, they are making a huge effort to build their own mapping data. They've been doing it for a few years now. You probably know or maybe have even seen the Apple vehicles driving around. They were using SUVs and vans for a while. They've recently changed to smaller sedans. They've got people on the streets. They've got people in bicycles. They've got an entire team of what they call ground truth folks that are taking reports and analyzing data, and they're working really, really hard to improve their system, and they're getting ready to roll out what they're calling their upgraded Apple Maps experience. They've actually already started doing it, and I didn't realize this, but I they had said they were going to roll it out in Northern California starting this year. I didn't realize how far they had gotten in. And what brought this up was Chris wrote in this week, and he says, you know, I'm in Fresno. I was recently notified that Fresno got the upgraded iOS 12 map experience. So this rolled out in, I think, iOS 12 beta, and it's going to be rolling out over the course of the next year and into the future in other parts of the United States. But Apple started with Northern California, and Chris noted that there's a lot more data and more accurate data and more recent data. He even said that the new satellite imagery actually showed his brand new car that he recently purchased in his driveway. So he knew it was updated and more recent data. And he says overall what he's noticing is a lot more detail, a lot better information, better routing options, more accurate arrival times, more information for local businesses and where things are in places like shopping centers, more details on schools and parks and those sorts of things. And those are all of the areas that Apple has said that they are trying to improve. And if you haven't seen Apple's mapping vehicles, there's actually a website you can go to. You can go to maps.apple.com/vehicles, and you can see where Apple is going to be operating their vehicles. Now, they don't go into a lot of specific details, but they list different regions and areas and timeframes when they're going to be operating their vehicles. But what they're doing for this upgraded maps experience is they're focusing on a lot of the tinier details, things like more detail in buildings and the shapes of buildings. They've got a lot more 3D modeling going on, more information about green spaces and walking paths and trails. And you can actually start to see this physically inside Apple Maps. Now, Apple promised to cover Northern California by the fall of this year in iOS 12, and you can actually see that they've achieved the goal by opening up the Maps app. If you look at California, you will see a line just above about the middle point of California. That's Paso Robles, Atascadero, that kind of area. And above that, to the north, there is a lot more green. There is a lot more detail. And you start to zoom in and you can see all of this detail that they've applied. They do say it's coming to the rest of the United States soon. They don't say specifically when, but it's really, really interesting. And you can see this both in iOS 12 in the maps and also on macOS Mojave. I don't know if it extends back to earlier versions or not, but definitely in those two versions, you'll see this very distinct line. And what you are going to see is more detailed ground cover, more foliage, pools, pedestrian pathways, sports venues, so like arenas and football fields and all those sorts of things, a lot more new high-resolution satellite data, a lot more detail in the map, and all of this is being done with Apple's own mapping data, and a lot of it is human edited and curated. So they're getting the data in, and then they are adjusting it, and they're tweaking it, and they are trying to make it better. And I'm hearing from more and more folks in our community who are in the areas who have received the upgraded maps that it is a lot better. So I can't wait for Apple to roll this out further. They need to get down to Southern California more quickly. And actually, they just need to get to the whole United States, because I know a lot of us are just, you know, Apple Maps is okay. It's not perfect. They've got a lot of third-party data, and I think they still are going to be using and supplementing with a lot of the third-party data, but to have their own physical data, stuff that they can react to and correct more quickly. You know, Apple has said they want to have the best mapping platform on the planet, and I think they are going to achieve it. If what they have achieved so far with Northern California is any indication, I think they are well on their way, and they could get to the point where they're as good, if not better, than Google Maps. I know some of you out there probably doubt it, but go take a look. You know, dive into that Northern California data and look at it, and let me know what you think. All right. A couple of pieces of software showed up this week, or were updated this week, with some really cool new features that I think address an issue that a few of you have had, or at least I've heard from a few of you in the MacCast community, with regard to loading data directly onto your iOS devices. This was something that Apple enabled in the past through iTunes, right? You could go in and for various applications, you could transfer files directly to your device, or you could go in and transfer music directly from your Mac into iTunes on your device. And over the years, that changed. A lot more stuff moved into the cloud, and a lot of those features went away. But a couple of app updates surfaced this week that bring back some of that kind of functionality. And I wanted to point these out. I don't think they were enough to kind of make a thing of the moment, but I wanted to point them out to you because, again, many of you have asked about this sort of thing in the past. And the first one is the podcast app Castro. And this is kind of cool because say, for example, the MacCast. I have done 680 episodes. This is the 680th episode of the MacCast. And I do not leave all of those episodes in the feed. I think the MacCast feed goes back about 50 episodes, and that's done on purpose. The reason I do that is so that new subscribers don't suddenly get, if their podcast app, you know, pulls down everything in the feed, they don't get 680 episodes. And I don't think there's actually any podcast apps that do that anymore. But the point is like, I don't have everything in the feed. And so very often someone will discover the show and they'll want to go back and listen to old episodes. And that's great, but there is often no really easy way for them to get those into their podcast app. Well, Castro has a feature called sideloading, and they actually improved it this week with a new share sheet extension. So if you have the Castro app, what you can do is you can visit a website with Safari on your iOS device, and if you come across an audio file, an MP3 file, you can click on the share sheet, and there is an option to sideload that audio content into Castro. And that means it will automatically copy it into the Castro application directly from the browser. And it actually works by copying the file into your iCloud documents folder. So it works through iCloud. Castro has a documents folder in there that it can read data out of, and it will load that right into the app. And I thought that was kind of a cool feature for a podcast app on iOS. So I wanted to point that one out. The other app that received an update is another one of my favorite apps on the Mac for managing my iOS devices, and that is iMazing. iMazing updated their Mac application with something they're calling Quick Transfer. And those of you who remember those days when in iTunes you could go and actually, you know, copy through the apps section files directly into specific applications, this kind of brings that feature back, but in an even better way, in my opinion, because what it gives you the ability to do is connect your device to your Mac with the Lightning cable, or with now the USB-C cable if you have a new iPad, and open up iMazing, and then you can literally take any files or documents, or almost anything that would be recognized by an app that would be on your iPad. So a text document, a Word document, a PDF, a video file, a MP3 file, an audio file. You can take those files, you can drag them onto your device in iMazing, and what iMazing will do is it will go through, it will detect what kinds of files you are trying to transfer to the device. It will then detect and display a list of the apps that are on your device that can recognize and manage and work with that file type, and then give you the ability to directly load that file into that application. And it is, for lack of a better word, amazing. It is really, really cool to be able to do that and to be able to do that intelligently. Now, I will tell you, it's not 100% perfect. You do kind of have to stick with one file type at a time. I tried doing a mixed file type, and while some applications do support that, if you're doing something specific like an audio file with a PDF and you want PDFs to go to one application and you want your audio files to go to another application, you have to do those separately. If you try to do them at the same time, it won't work. So be aware of that. I also was struggling with some of the metadata on my my media files. So like I took and tried transferring a podcast directly into iTunes, and while the audio came across, the metadata, like the album art and the show notes and the description and all that stuff, that did not transfer across. And I'm not really sure why that is, because that data is embedded in the file. But at the very least, I got the audio file into the right place, or I got a PDF into the Documents application or into PDF Pen and was able to do that. So that worked out great. And it was just really, really cool. And what another cool thing about this is that you're able to do it without being attached to a single iTunes library. That was a problem that you had with going through iTunes in the past, was that once you connected your device to one iTunes library, if you wanted to transfer a file from another Mac that had a different iTunes library, it would try to make you reconnect or reauthorize or resync with that Mac instead of the original Mac. And you couldn't mix and match. You had to go from one to the other. The iMazing Quick Transfer option doesn't require that. And best of all, Quick Transfer is available in the free version of the iMazing apps, either iMazing or iMazing Mini. So you can use this completely for free. You don't have to buy the application. So I thought these two things were really, really cool, and I just wanted to point them out on the MacCast this week. So you might want to check those out. Okay, last thing that I have for you this week is actually a discussion we've had in the past on the MacCast, and it actually came about from an article over on Apple Insider, and they rehashed this week because we are dealing with USB-C once again, right? We have iPads that support USB-C, we have new Macs out that are using USB-C and Thunderbolt 3, and there is a huge confusion and problem with Thunderbolt and USB-C, really USB 3.1 cables. And the problem is that it's really hard to know or understand how these cables work and what kind of functionality you get out of these cables in terms of data transfer performance, in terms of power performance. Right? Because all of these allow you to connect, to transfer data, well, potentially transfer data, and also to use power across the cables. But it turns out all of these cables are not created equal, and how you tell one from the other is very, very difficult. So I thought we would rehash this. I'm going to actually link to the full article over at Apple Insider in the show notes at maccast.com, and we're not going to go as deep as their article does, so I encourage you, please go read their full article, because it is really, really good at explaining this stuff. But I kind of want to run down the basics for you, just so you have an idea of you know, what to look out for when you're looking to buy a Thunderbolt 3 cable or a USB 3.1 cable. So USB-C, Thunderbolt 3, USB 3.1, and how these things relate to connectivity and cables with your Mac and your iOS devices. And the first thing you absolutely need to know and to understand is when you hear the term USB-C, that is just a connector. nothing more. It is that connector that is being used. It has nothing to do with speed. It has nothing to do with data transfer rates. It has nothing to do with power. That is something completely different. And just to make this a little bit more confusing, Thunderbolt 3 can operate over a USB-C connector. So USB 3.1 and Thunderbolt 3 both use or can use USB-C connectors. But when we say USB-C, we're just talking about that round reversible connector. And that's it. So know that first and foremost. Next, Thunderbolt 3. Thunderbolt 3 has a bunch of different levels that it can perform at. The optimal level is 40 gigabits per second. And to do 40 gigabits per second, Thunderbolt 3 needs to be running over a USB-C connection at both ends of the cable. All right, so be aware of that. Now, USB 3.1, and that's what we're talking about when we're talking about the most current version of USB. And there's actually, I think, a couple different revisions. There is a version that runs at 5 gigabits per second. And there is also a newer version, I think version 2, that runs at 10 gigabits per second. Both of those do not need USB-C on both ends to get the optimal performance, but it does need it on one end. You need a USB-C connection on the host device. So be aware of that. Now, some Thunderbolt 3 cables can work as USB 3.1 type C cables, but not all of them. Luckily, in reverse, it gets a little bit simpler because a USB 3.1 type C cable is never a Thunderbolt 3 cable. So even though they look the same and have the same USB-C connectors, if it's a USB 3.1 type C cable, it will not transfer Thunderbolt. It will not work as a Thunderbolt cable. You need specifically a Thunderbolt cable for that. And again, remember, some Thunderbolt 3 cables can work as USB 3.1 type C cables. So if you want the most compatibility, you're going to want to look for cables that are Thunderbolt 3 cables and that support USB 3.1. All right. Now let's talk about the cable that Apple gives you in the box with your new MacBook or MacBook Pro. It is a USB-C charging cable. It is typically rated for up to 87 watts, and it will adapt to whatever charging power or whatever the charging power is of the lowest rated component that you're using it with. So if you're using that cable with a 60 watt wall plug, it is only going to deliver 60 watts. Or if you're plugging it into a Mac that is only needing 60 watts, it is only going to deliver 60 watts. So you can't get it to drive more just by plugging it into a, you know, bigger power brick. So if you're using an 87 watt power brick and an 87 watt rated cable, but you're connecting to a 60 watt MacBook Pro, then it's only going to deliver 60 watts, which is exactly how you would want it to be. But the other thing to know about that cable that Apple includes in the box is that it is not a USB 3.1 cable. It's actually a USB 2.0. So it's really only a charging cable. It's not going to transfer data at the fastest possible USB 3.1 speed. Yeah, thanks, Apple, right? This is that little bit of that nickel and diming that we've talked about in the prior episode of the MacCast. So you are going to want, if you want USB 3.1 cables, you're going to need to buy those USB 3.1 cables. You're not getting it in the box with your new MacBook or MacBook Pro. And then moving back to Thunderbolt 3 cables, there are a couple different kinds of Thunderbolt 3 cables. There are passive cables, and there are active cables. And the main difference is how far you can go and maintain your Thunderbolt 3 speeds. Now, shorter cables in Thunderbolt 3 tend to be passive cables, and they are fine for fast data transfer speeds over short distances. So these are typically the cables you'll find with like a Thunderbolt hub, those sorts of things. If you need to go further, though, you're going to want an active cable, something that can boost the signal along the way. The only problem is that while passive cables are generally USB 3.1 compatible, active cables generally are not. So if you want a cable that will do both Thunderbolt 3 and USB 3.1, you're typically looking at a shorter cable. I don't know if longer ones tend to exist. If they do, I would imagine they're somewhat expensive. And it, again, would be a thing that you would need to specifically be on the lookout for and look in the specs for when you're buying a Thunderbolt 3 cable. And so related to all of this, as you can tell, what kind of cable, and that's kind of the point of this whole conversation, what kind of cable you buy becomes very, very specific and very, very important. The downside of this is all of these cables are likely going to have a USB-C connector on both ends. So once you get it out of the box and out of the packaging, it gets really hard to know which cable is which and which cable has which features because there's no symbols, there's no markings, there's no text on most of these cables that are going to tell you anything. So you are going to want to come up with some sort of labeling system for your cables, whether you're using tape or special tags that you can buy, and they do have them. You are going to want to attach something to your cables and really specifically write on them, hey, this is a Thunderbolt 3 that supports USB 3.1, or this is a USB 3.1 cable, or this is the, you know, charging cable that I got out of the box with my Apple product that only does USB 2.0. You are going to want to label those things and make sure that you keep track of it, right? So I wish I had better news in the USB-C Thunderbolt 3 cable department, but I don't. It's really a mess for consumers at this point, and now you have been warned, you have been educated, so I feel like my job has been done. There is one little last thing I want to mention. It's kind of potentially a light at the end of the tunnel. It is a chipset that Intel has developed called the Titan Ridge chipset for Thunderbolt 3 cables. It is coming soon and has the promise to deliver a universal USB-C cable capable of USB 3.1 Type-C or Thunderbolt 3 and supplying 100 watts of power on a cable up to 2 meters long, and possibly, I would assume, at a cost, but this is ultimately, I think, going to be the kind of universal cable. You're going to want to find the thing that has a Titan Ridge chipset in it, and then you are going to be covered. But unfortunately, these aren't out on the market yet. They are coming, but it is something to potentially be on the lookout for. So I will try to remember to update you if I do see that these cables are out and available here on the MacCast. But until then, again, hopefully you find this information helpful when you're out there trying to figure out what kinds of cables to buy for your new Mac or your new iPad Pro. And with that, that is going to do it for the show for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank our show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, and Text Expander for iOS, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad. You can get more information and details on their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/MacCast. The MacCast is also supported by listeners like you, those of you who support the show through Patreon. You can get more information and details on how to do that by visiting patreon.com/MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. The community is a big part of the MacCast, so if you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, please send me your emails and your audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9, and you can leave a voicemail message there. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you'd like to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. But that will do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.